Okay, welcome everyone. So, first of all, actually, a very big thank you to Tova and Mendy. Mendy's actually not here. He was traveling, but Tova still said, not a problem, we could do it in the house. It was supposed to be somewhere else, but we unfortunately had to cancel that. That will take place at a different time. So, a big thank you for last minute opening up your home. So, tonight's shiur was actually planned. Supposed to be in Double Bay at the Biarski home, but it was planned actually before I went to Israel. And we sort of discussed the topic, and I had a hunch that Israel trip would have something to do with the shiur, just from the topic. So I'll just touch on the topic, but really I want to share with you a very relevant part of the experiences that I had in Israel just the last week. So those that don't know, so I traveled last week to Israel with a group of rabbis from Sydney and New South Wales in general. One rabbi from Newcastle, and it was like a mission. There were 16 rabbis, 8 rebbetzins, and we had this packed program for 5-6 days. And it was actually transformative, really informative and transformative. And I'm not going to share everything tonight because that'll take much more than an hour. But I do want to share some of the ideas which I think are so relevant and so important for us to try and internalize. I will say that if you haven't been there since Simchat Torah, since October the 7th, it's very recommended, only because as much as you read and as much as you watch videos, there's actually a saying in the Talmud that you cannot compare hearing to seeing, or seeing to hearing. And it's just very, very powerful. For reasons that, I mean, obviously I'm going to share with you the way I saw it, my perspective. I think other people see it that way too, similarly, but every person has their own experience, obviously. So let me just begin with the concept. The concept is that over the last year and a half particularly, I think people have been struggling a bit, or a lot. In general, we live in a confused world, a crazy world at the moment. There's so many ridiculous things happening. Rise of anti-Semitism, the whole war in Israel, mixed messages from nations that we thought were our friends, mixed messages from nations that are our friends. It's just very, very hard and very confusing. A lot of people have family in Israel. A lot of people have no people that are affected by the whole story in Israel and so on. And people have a lot of uncertainty. You know, the Talmud says there's no greater joy than clarity, right? Ein simcha katarat ha-svekot. And when people are uncertain, they don't know what's happening tomorrow, they don't know what's happening next week, it becomes very difficult. And over the last year and a half, many people have spoken to me about this, about the feeling of anxiety, the feeling of isolation, the feeling of uncertainty, and just how do you overcome that, and so on. So before I went, I used to tell people, you know, because just from what I've read and what I saw, maybe what we should do is we should look at people who are actually experiencing it, not just we are observers at the end of the day, but we should look at people who are actually going through this in Israel and see how they approach it. And I had a kind of a hunch and sort of a perspective of what that would look like, but seeing it is just something different, and I want to share with you sort of a whole perspective of ideas, because, you know, you see what's happening, you can actually experience it, you can feel it, and you can also learn how people in Israel are responding to pain, to PTSD, to challenges, to all the things that are happening as they experience it. So obviously this is a very big discussion, and you can discuss this topic from many different angles. But tonight I'm going to just take one angle and sort of a couple of highlights. So I'm going to mention something that the Zohar says, which is very relevant tonight, because tomorrow night is Lag BaOmer, which is the yahrzeit of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the great tzaddik Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who was the author of the Zohar, the magnum opus of Jewish mysticism and Kabbalah and so on. And there's a saying in the Zohar, in a bit of a different context, but it's the same idea. And it's brought down in Hasidic philosophy about the concept of people feeling uncomfortable with doing something wrong in the process of repentance, and sometimes even bringing themselves to an emotional state of tears, sometimes, like we do on Yom Kippur, sometimes Rosh Hashanah or daily, whatever the case might be. And at the same time, to harbor that feeling with intense joy. Because he says every Jew has to be joyous. We have an neshama, we have a soul. The soul is connected to God. Even when we sin and transgress and fail, the soul is still pure and connected with God, so there's a tremendous joy that comes with that. But at the same time, our consciousness, on a conscious level, sometimes we fail, and it's, how do we bring those emotions together? And he quotes the Zohar, and the Zohar says that the Jew has an neshama, a soul, that soul is godly, and therefore because it's godly, it's kind of infinite, it has an infinity energy to it, and the infinite energy allows us to live a paradox, to actually have two emotions at the same time. The way the Zohar puts it is, he talks about the left part of the heart and the right part of the heart, which is more, one is the animal soul, one is the godly soul, and he talks about having happiness on the one side of the heart and pain or crying or tears even on the other part of the heart, right? So that sort of that living with opposites, which is a difficult thing to understand how one does that, but he says a person can do that. We have the strength because we can transcend our normal. Normally people sort of, when they get caught up in an emotion, they're kind of very locked into that emotion. We can transcend that and we can actually combine opposites, right? And that concept, that paradox, I mean, I knew this before, and I'm sure most people know this already, but when you go to Israel now, you see it in real time, in real life, every single day. Summed up in, I'll just tell you, like one of the nights we had a dinner in a restaurant in Yerushalayim. They have good restaurants there, actually. Really, really, really nice restaurants, right? Well, by the way, people are absolutely living life to the fullest there. It's like unbelievable. This restaurant in Ma Miller, and they have this like, they have like five rooms there. Like they're all packed and all very much enjoying themselves. And we had a speaker. That particular dinner was sponsored by the UIA, and they asked a speaker, a woman that works for them in Yerushalayim, to come and speak to us. And she spoke to us what's happening there and what, you know, the whole UIA contribution and so on. And she said one line, which was amazing, and it's kind of summed it up. She said, here in Israel, we are broken, but we are unbreakable. And that was like the line. That was the theme of the trip, in a way. So I'll tell you, for example, every experience we had there really ended the same way, in a way. Very different perspectives and very different stories and experiences. But it ended with this idea. And I'll tell you this particular story. So we were in down south. And down south, we did many things, which were very painful. Saw things which were very painful, of course. And we also visited an army base. We visited the same army base twice that day. One in the morning, one in the afternoon, because in the morning, we went to see, I don't know if some of you might know, he's an ex-Sydney guy, Ari Briggs. So he's very, very involved in a whole project now that they're doing in Israel to train civilians as first responders. It's Konanut, they call it there or something, right? Because what happened on October 7th was that a lot of the yeshivim, a lot of the kibbutzim over there were completely under-resourced in terms of ammunition and skill and training. Right, and the army wasn't around, as we know, you know the whole story. So that's what they're doing now. They have this whole training session, which is being done through the army and through different people. And Ari Briggs is very involved, so he took us to this army base. We watched some of the training, watched the shooting, and the shooting range there, which is interesting. And after this guy Yiftach. So let me talk about Yiftach. Yiftach is a regular civilian. He's a medical scientist. He does medical research. He has a day job. Not a particularly religious person, but he lived in the kibbutz called Ein Mapsod. That's what it's called, something like that. It's one of the smaller yeshivim there. And he told us a story of what happened there, which is an incredible story. There was no one really, there was no guns, there was no ammunition, and they heard the enemy coming. One of the things the enemy did was they tried to make sure that the kibbutzim shouldn't be able to close the gates. And they put something there, they sent someone to put something there, something I didn't exactly understand the details, but and they were trying to close the gate remotely and they couldn't, and they were running towards the front, him and his brother and a bunch of other people running towards the front of this yeshuv to protect and to fight. But they didn't have any munitions, so he picked up a rock and he saw his friend picking up an axe. He tells us a story, like, you know, there's a bit of human everything. He says to his friend, "What are you doing with the axe? Like, what are you going to do with the axe?" He says, "What are you going to do with the rock?" But they went and they were ready to fight. Anyway, miraculously, and he says miraculously, he says, God saved us that day miraculously. They were actually able to close the gate, which hindered the whole progression of the terrorists coming into that particular area, different to other areas, of course. And he said, God made a miracle for us that day and we were saved. But it was extremely traumatic. And I mean, the story was telling was usually, some of them did get wounded. His brother got really wounded. Thank God he's okay today, he's fine. And he was there on the army base itself. We were introduced to both of them. Elad, I think his name was. So it was Yiftach and Elad. And this Yiftach, for his yeshiva, he's now very involved working with Ari Briggs in the training of the civilians. And I'm looking at him talk, and he's telling this whole story, and I notice that he's telling a very traumatic story, but he's very positive. He's not telling a traumatic story like someone who's traumatized. He's telling a very traumatic story, painting the pain and the challenge very, very vividly. And yet he's very upbeat and very positive and talking about training people and rebuilding the issue, all the whole stuff, right? So I'm a guy that when I go on these tours, I don't like to ask questions. I like to listen. But it was really, I needed to understand that. I needed to chap it. So when we finished, I just walked over to him privately and I said to him, can I ask you a question? He says, of course. So I said to him, Yiftach, I was just listening to you. Just tell me how you stay so positive after this. So he looks at me, a completely secular Israeli Jew. He says to me, what do you mean? We're Jewish. We're Jewish, he says. This is our land. This is what God wants. We're doing this for thousands of years. Okay, my parents were Holocaust survivors. They rebuilt. We rebuilt. Okay, this war, that war. Unbelievable, right? So I was analyzing it afterwards and also having a look at things that we saw afterwards and before and so on. And I realized what's happening there is this, right? I can tell you that they're not in denial at all. There's a lot of pain in Israel at the moment, a lot of pain. They're not, people sometimes are upbeat and positive because they're in denial and they're escaping. No one's escaping there. They're experiencing it. And I got to tell you, some of the speakers were so amazing that they weren't like tour guides. They were like talking from the heart and talking experientially. And there were some very heavy days that like they brought us into their pain. It was like quite amazing, right? And different types of challenges. You know, it's interesting, just parenthetically, that when you're not there, we talk about every time, God forbid, we read about a fallen soldier. So that's obviously a major tragedy, right? But there are so many other components of challenge and pain there. Besides political stuff, but I'm talking about just on the ground. We went one day to, we were in the north, we were in Kiryat Shmoneh. And we had, an amazing speaker. And Kiryat Shmoneh was a town in the north that was evacuated right after the war started. And the residents of Kiryat Shmoneh had no idea what the plan was. Because when the war broke out, the focus was trying to get soldiers to the south and the north to fight a war. What had to be evacuated was evacuated, but without a plan. Mind you, nothing in Israel is with a particular plan, but this was really without a plan, right? And they didn't understand what was happening. They were sent to hotels. They didn't even know where they were going at first. And they also thought they're going for a few weeks. And those few weeks turned into almost a year and a half. The evacuation officially only ended like a number of weeks ago, right? And he was describing so clearly what the challenge of evacuation looks like. I mean, we don't stop and think about it. I don't remember anyone really talking in great detail about it. We always talk about what they're doing in Gaza, they're winning, what are they bombing, and God forbid, what soldiers are hurt or injured or whatever, or died. And this is a whole other thing. I'm talking about thousands and thousands of people who, some of them, their houses were hit by missiles afterwards. Thank God they're alive because they weren't there. We visited some of those houses. I have to just tell you a very a humorous part to Israel, which is like typical of Israel. You know, we went through two houses in Kiryat Shmoneh that were hit by missiles, burnt out because the missile then activates a fire, and the whole place is burnt and gutted and just a complete mess. We went into them, we walked through the houses, and I was thinking to myself, it's interesting. In Australia, where they haven't got much to worry about, they only worry about small details, so, such a site will be cordoned off, you'd never be able to go there, OHS, all nicely, right? In Israel, we're about to go in, the guy just makes one half an announcement. He says, when you go in, be careful, there's a few things on the floor. And then you walk in, there's a few things on the floor. There's rubble all over the place, there's wires. Then I haven't got time to worry about these things in Israel anyway. But it was very, very impactful. We came out of one of these houses and one of the rabbis says to me, he says, in Australia, our problem is when someone takes your rubbish bin in the morning and he puts his own rubbish and so you don't have enough place, right? That's the trauma we experience here. But he went into, he gave us this amazing statistics and numbers and people coming back, not being back, and businesses and factories that were affected because now civilians, and then people losing everything, their whole memories, their furniture, their treasured thing, and then displacement. And then now the government was giving them a little bit of stipend, but they're not giving them anymore because the evacuation is now over. But many people don't want to come back because their kids are in school, so they went, right? They land up in a hotel. There's no laundry, so they had to have this whole organization that had to buy washing machines and put them in the lobby of hotels. That was happening, right? I had no idea. Like, it was like a whole nother area of the challenge of the war, right? And of course, there's injured soldiers. People don't talk enough about the injured soldiers. I mean, every injured soldier is a whole family. And there's more injured soldiers. There's a lot of injured soldiers this war, more than other wars. Apparently because they're a better army now, so less people fall. I mean, unfortunately, so many people did fall. But less people fall and more people get injured. So that we left with so many injured soldiers, some of them with permanent damage, some of them with not permanent damage, but... So it's huge, right? So they're not in denial, and yet they are so positive. Every speech you hear is all about. The ones who are a bit more involved in Yiddishkeit is about Amunah and about faith and about rebuilding. All of them about this is our land. This is what we've got to do, because they have an incredible sense of purpose. That's what you see in Israel. Purpose, right? We live in a society today that a lot of people don't have purpose. It's one of the reasons why mental health is so high, mental health issues are so high, and so many other challenges. Unhappiness is so rampant. I don't know if you know this, but Israel was, before the war, the fourth happiest country in the world. And it was the war just downgraded it to number five, that's all.
No, it's eighth.
Huh?
I think it's
eighth. Eight now? Okay, it's been tough. Okay, maybe when I heard it was a few months ago, it was five. Okay. Whatever it is, eight is not bad either.
No.
After what they've gone through, right?
Well ahead of Australia.
Oh, yeah, that doesn't surprise me, but I mean, yeah. Why? Because when you have a sense of purpose, of course, Viktor Frankl spoke about this a lot, and I'm doing our Thursday morning series on Viktor Frankl stuff, we're going to talk about it more, but people need meaning. The human being is designed to have meaning. And on all different levels, in all different ways of expressing it, Israelis have an incredible sense of purpose. They don't have time to define themselves by their past and by their pain and by their challenge. It's real. There's PTSD, there's trauma, there's a lot of stuff going on there and a lot of support that they're building to be able to deal with it. But overall, they just know they have to keep moving. They have to keep moving because they have a purpose. They have a destination, they have a goal. They have something they have to achieve, and that's to have a country. To have a country which is a holy country, to have a country which for their families, to have a country they can defend, they can rebuild. So the sense of rebuilding there. There's no like, oh, we give up, you know. No, we've done this before, we're going to rebuild. The sense of purpose is an incredible thing. So what happens is, and I think this is what happens with pain and challenge, right? That when you have pain and challenge, you do one of two things. Either you become caught and defined by the pain, and that leads to paralysis and despair. Emotional paralysis and despair and despondency, or the pain is channeled, and it's channeled to induce an incredible sense of urgency. Urgency to move forward, urgency to do what is right, and urgency to do what is needed, right? And that's really what's happening there. And you see it, the channeling, you see so much of it. So up north, we visited a family, just telling you different things as they come, you know, as I was remembering them. The Shushan family. The Shushan family it's Michael, and I've forgotten his wife's name because she only came in the middle. So I've forgotten her name. Anyway, but Michael Shushan is an Israeli, religious Israeli. He lives in Ma'alot. And they lost a son, Yair, a few months ago in the war. Just a few months ago. And they speak, and they're willing to speak already, and they're not, you know, they were obviously in the beginning were not able to, but now they are, or want to. First we walked in, it was amazing, you know, Israelis, very hospitable, so we come in there, we get back to hear from the bereaved family, but first, lit om mashu, you have to eat something, so there's a whole spread of fruit and nuts and cake and who knows what, right? I don't think we like knew what to do exactly, because it's not the kind of setting that we were going to sit down and have cake and fruit, right? But anyway, and he spoke about his son. I've heard about it. I mean, the most amazing person, a very religious soldier. He showed us, he made himself, he was very into his own time management. And he showed us, I have a picture of it, he showed us his son's learning. He made himself a schedule, what he wanted to learn every day. The Torah that he wanted to learn every day. When he was in yeshiva, before the war broke out, he was in a Hezder yeshiva. Incredible. I mean, I don't know. He showed it around, he passed it around, so one rabbi made a joke. This is for all the rabbis combined, right? Like, I mean, like, you wanted to learn this page of Gemara, that page of Gemara, and this thing, and that thing. Like, it was an incredible person, very, very humble person, apparently. And he fell in battle. And I'm mentioning the learning because his parents knew that learning was so important to him. So they've now channeled it. They want to just make, they're raising money to build a Beit Midrash, a place of learning in the honor of their son, right? This is like sort of... On Shabbat, let's say another beautiful story. On Shabbat, we spent Shabbat in Alon Shvut. Very different community. I'm not used to that kind of community. It was. I mean, I know people like that, but I was saying it's not the community I normally connect with when I go to Israel. Very, very different community, beautiful place actually. So Alon Shvut is part of the Gush Etzion municipality. So there's a number of different, I don't know, I still can't get the difference between the yeshiva and the kibbutz and the moshav and depending on how many people there are, whatever that much exactly, whatever it is. But Alon Shvut is a beautiful place and a lot of very special people live there. Also filled, all the sort of modern Orthodox people, but filled with emunah and faith and purpose. It's just so you can feel it, you can touch it. And one of the people that live there is a woman by the name of Cheryl Mandel. Cheryl Mandel lost a son. She has a very interesting story. She spoke to us, and first of all, she grew up in Canada, completely secular, until she got married. She never even saw in her life a Shabbos candle. Her mother-in-law was a little bit traditional, so the first time she saw a Shabbos candle was when she got married, and her mother-in-law's house saw a Shabbos candle. They had a bunch of kids, and then somehow, I think the husband got a bit more into Torah mitzvot, into Yiddishkeit, and engaging more in Judaism, and learning, and things like that. And eventually she went along with the ride, and they made Aliyah, and they moved to Alon Shvut. And now they're just a regular religious family. She's over 70 now. This happened, she didn't lose a son in this war. It was way back, I think like 12 years ago, on some mission. They had intelligence, there were some terrorists hiding somewhere, and they went to get them, but the terrorists had a whole lookout system, and they noticed them, and he was killed. And she's like over 70. She's a humorous lady, very funny, beautifully spoken, just very, very amazing. And she told us about her son, and she told us about the whole story, and about her own story, and so on. And at the end, she told us the following story. The story is like this. She says, because obviously wanted to know, she was once in Sydney, I don't know if anyone heard her when she was here, but she told the story of sort of how she goes on. So first she told us about a very credible dream that she had. She had a dream where, in her dream, she saw a whole bunch of young people around a table, enjoying themselves, eating and talking and loading. And then at the side was her son, looking very reserved, and he was like in a corner. This is, she tells us that she had this dream. And she.
Was this dream after he passed
away? Yeah, after he passed away. Okay. After he was killed, yeah. And she runs over to him in the dream and hugs him, and she says to him, "Why are you so sad?" So he says, in the dream, it's a fascinating dream. No, because I'll tell you why it's fascinating, because actually the concept is written in Sfarim, actually. Lubavitcher Rebbe talks about it in a number of letters to people who prolonged. I mean, in Yiddishkeit, you have to grieve, but you're supposed to then move, you know, gain strength and channel it and so on. And she tells him, he tells her in the dream, "I can't be happy when you're sad." And she realized that she needs to, you know, because obviously she was broken. And she had the courage and the strength to channel and to change course kind of thing. And how did she do it? She did it with the following story. She told us a story about her son. The following story. The story was that he was, when he did his training for the army, it was the last day of training. And apparently in the army, when you train, at the end of the last day of training, they go on with like this crazy hike for like kilometers and kilometers, where all the soldiers have to wear their, you know, their vest and ammunition, and basically it's very heavy, and they have to show that they can do this, right? And apparently there's one, I don't know what it is, it's a very heavy gun or some heavy piece of ammunition that is also given, but it's given to one person to carry as well, which is like an additional, I don't know, 8 kilos or something. And it's given normally to like the strongest and the tallest of the group, because the commander reckons that's the person that's going to be able to handle it. So he gives it to this person, not her son, and they start, and they're walking, or they're running, whatever they're doing, and suddenly the guy that was carrying this extra piece of ammunition collapses. So her son, Daniel, his name, he was a lieutenant, Daniel walks over to the guy who collapsed, just to see if he's okay, to help him out. And the commander sees him doing that, And the commander screams out to him, Sanders, you pick up that piece of ammunition. I don't know what the word for it in Hebrew was. She told us, but I don't remember. And he looks at the commander like, me? Like, I'm a short guy. Like, I'm not exactly. So all he does is screams out again, Sanders, pick up the ammunition. And he does. And he keeps going. And he makes it to the finishing line and he's fine. And she said, and this is like what Israelis do. She said, I realized that I'm also on a journey. And the journey sometimes is called life. And life has to have meaning and purpose and happiness. And sometimes people collapse in the middle. But we have a commander. The commander's Hashem. And the commander's saying to me, Sanders, get up. Pick up the ammunition and keep walking. Keep on the journey. And she's telling, and she said that's what she lives with. She lives with, she's, obviously pain never goes away. But we know from psychological research, pain can never go away. You can live with pain, but at the same time, you can also channel the pain and give the pain meaning. So she decided that's her journey. Her journey is to speak, her journey is to inspire people. She says, she's a very funny woman, so she says, I know that Daniel would not want me to be sad. Also know he would not want me to speak about him. But he can't have everything. So I'm not sad, like a real mother. She says, you can't have everything. So I'll speak about him, but and then, when she finishes, just the kind of person she is, when she finishes, we were like just mesmerized, right? She went on, I mean, she spoke a lot of different things, but we were just mesmerized. And then she says, now I have two favors to ask you, she says, before I go. First of all, she says, I've become a bit of a Breslover lately. That's what she says. See, my Breslover are very into happiness. So there's a song the Breslover sing, Mitzvah Gadola Liyot Besimcha. I don't know if you've heard of the song. So she says, I want you to sing two songs for me. I want you to sing Mitzvah Gadola Liyot Besimcha. And I want you to sing Kol Olam Kulo. You know, Gesher Tzar Mo'od, right? Because Va'ikar Lo Levached, the main thing is not to be afraid. And we do that. And we all, some of us got up. We were dancing, actually. Like, it was very beautiful. And then she says, the second thing I want for you is, and this is like, again, the channeling, right? Second thing she says, I want you all to take upon yourself a mitzvah. Do a mitzvah in honor of my son. Right? So I guess that's what I'm trying to bring out, that is the sense of mission there, the sense of purpose is so strong. The pain is real, but the sense of mission is really strong, really purposed, right? And that's, I think, we can all take that. I mean, it doesn't have to be big challenges. Sometimes, you know, we get down and we kind of get unfocused and all frazzled because we have small challenges, but it's about where are we going. I want to share with you actually an idea, nothing to do with just an idea that I learned a few weeks ago. A few weeks ago in the parsha, there was the laws of Tzarat, the laws of leprosy, right? And leprosy is a plague, and it's called a plague in the Torah, nega, and it's impure, and it's the whole thing. If a person becomes impure from a nega, from a plague of Tzarat, of leprosy, he has to go through the whole process, he's got to be isolated and quarantined until he becomes better and so on. So there's a Kabbalistic book called Sefer Yetzirah. Sefer Yetzirah is the book that deals with how God created the world and all the Kabbalistic formations and letters of the Aleph Beis, and very deep Kabbalistic book. One of the things that says there in Sefer Yetzirah, it says there, Ein lamata minega, there's nothing worse than a nega. Nega means a plague. A bodily plague. But ve'ein lemala, there's nothing better than oneg, which means pleasure. Now, it's a play on words because nega is nun gimel ayin, and if you change down the letters, it's the same word as oneg. So nega and oneg are really the same letters, but it says nothing worse than nega, nothing better than oneg. The question is, what does that mean? Like, what's the message there, right? So there's a rabbi, one of the rabbis, Twersky, I don't know which one, who is living today as a rabbi somewhere. He wrote a book on the parsha. I never knew about this book, but when my daughter was in seminary, one of the teachers used to use this book a lot for the parsha shiur. And I discovered this book, and it's got some beautiful things in it sometimes. I have a computer program that has like a library of thousands and thousands of svarim, so I found it there. And he says something very beautiful. He says the following. He says, what's the difference between a person, and I think this is what I'm trying to explain, right? What's the difference between a person who fails or something bad happens and they just can't unlock themselves, they just remain trapped, or the person that doesn't do that? The difference is, he says like this, it depends what you focus on. If you focus on the past, on what happened, right, You keep on wallowing and you keep on ruminating on what happened in terms of the failure and the challenges and the tragedies and so on and so forth. So then you're locked, right? But if you look, if you detach from what happened in a way, and your focus is on what could happen, what I can do today, tomorrow, the future, where's the mission? Where do I still have to go to, right? He connects it with what God told the Jewish people when they left Egypt, when they thought they couldn't leave Egypt, because they had become spiritually so sunken in the roots, in the depths of impurity. God says, no, don't worry about that. I'm going to take you out. You have to focus on going towards your destination. The destination was the Mount Sinai, becoming God's nation. Just keep on moving there. At the Yam Suf, at the sea, when the Jews started to panic because they couldn't split the sea, there was water in front of them and the Egyptians were pursuing them, God said the same thing. God said to Moses, just talk to the people and tell them, focus on the goal, v'yisol, just travel. Keep going. And then Nachshon, the famous thing, that Nachshon ben Aminadav, the leader of Yehuda, the tribe of Yehuda, he said, well, if we've got to keep going, we're going. And he went into the sea and he got wet. And then the sea split. In other words, focus on where you're going. Focus on the goal and the challenges will take care of themselves. If you use the challenges, you can channel the challenges, but you've got to keep going. So he says the most beautiful thing. He says, that's the difference between nega and oneg. So listen to this. I thought it was amazing. I hope you like it too. There's three letters here. Nun, Gimel, and Ayin. So Nun and Gimel is the person. Why? Because Nun is neshama, soul, and Gimel is guf. So body and soul, that's the person. What's Ayin? Ayin, it comes to the word an eye. It's a perspective, what you look at. If you take the word nega, the Ayin is at the end. In other words, the Ayin is looking back at what happened. So where's the eye? The eye is focused on the first two letters, looking backwards. Says the Sefer Yisrael, that's a nega, that's a plague. Ein lemata min nega, nothing worse than that. Then you're locked. You won't move. If you keep looking, keep getting trapped in what happened and defining yourself by yesterday, there's nothing worse than that. Then nothing can happen. But ein lemala, there's nothing better than oneg. What's oneg? Oneg, the ayin is in the beginning of the word. It's looking forward. It's looking to the next letters. It's looking to the future. Nothing better than that. That's the foundation. A person can learn to do that, to stay focused on the goal. Nothing better than that. Then everything else falls into place. Again, you don't ignore the pain, but you bring the pain with you to make it as to facilitate stronger and better and more intensely and in a greater way working towards the goal. So I think that's, I gave this shiur a number of weeks ago, but then I thought about it again in Israel because like this is exactly what's going on there, right? It's just the most amazing people. Which comes together with another thing that I noticed there, which is an incredible and incredible sense of sacrifice, of learning that you don't reach a goal without effort and without discomfort. And the dedication there to be able to actually almost volunteer for sacrifice is unbelievable. I met up one of the rabbis that gave us a shiur in Alon Shvut is a guy called Rabbi Rafi Ostroff. It's funny, I caught up with him. He's from South Africa. He lived around the corner from me.
Huh?
He's a little younger than me. His older brother was a friend of mine. And then, I mean, they went to Israel. They made Aliyah, I think, when I was in high school. And I saw him once, and his brother I haven't seen since then. He's a rabbi in Alon Shvut. He does different things. And we also share a cousin. So I have a first cousin through my mother's side. And it was her mother, my mother, our sisters, and her father's brother's daughter is married to this Rafi Ostroff. So like we share a cousin. Anyway. So my cousin was telling me, before we went to Alon Shvut, because we were talking about going to Alon Shvut, he said, oh, you're Rafi Ostroff, my cousin lives there. He's 58 to 59, long finished his army service, long finished his reserve, the Miluim, as they call it there. And he just spent like 100 days in the army. He volunteered. Yeah. Israel's at war. The land needs to be protected. He volunteers. And you find that all the time over there. There are people there that are older that are doing now, since the war started, like fifth or sixth round of Miluim. Just just because, again, such purpose and willing to be dedicated, even to sacrifice yourself for that service. Like it's just incredible. It's absolutely incredible. And you know what that means? It's not just their sacrifice, right? It's family sacrifice. I mean, his wife and kids haven't... He came out for Pesach and then went back in after Pesach. So like, and then he was there for Shabbos now, but he, and I think he's finishing now, but he, they haven't, like, they don't see the family, the businesses, he can't do work. It's like, it's an extended sacrifice, which is incredible. The other thing that's also amazing there, and I think there's something we really have to work on and internalize, that despite the challenge of what's happened there, it's almost like the opposite of what we think would happen, maybe. But there's an explosion of Yiddishkeit and emunah. Unbelievable. I was talking to soldiers in the army base, you know, going around with the soldiers. No, some of them were religious. Most of them were not religious, actually, in that base. But they were talking about, you know, yes, it's God and emunah, and it's going to be okay, and then they're like this, right? And also, connecting to mitzvot, which is an amazing thing. There's thousands, I don't know why this mitzvah particularly among the soldiers, but there's thousands and thousands of soldiers that have put on tzitzis since the war started, right? Thousands of soldiers have started putting on tefillin. Not just once in a while, but started putting on tefillin every day. And the army base, as I do whenever there's a large group of Jews, went around because we were schmoozing and it was a time like, you know, it wasn't a lecture time or anything. So I walked around with my tefillin. I asked soldiers that wanted to put on tefillin. So many that actually I expected that they wouldn't have put on tefillin that day. Says, no, nachti ayom. I put on today. What do you mean? You know, Israelis talk with their hands, with their... You know? Nachti kvar, you know. I said, oh, yo, yafem, oh, fantastic. Look at those, didn't, and they put on anyways. Amazing. And there's been a race. Like, it's very difficult to actually service that. Like, I don't know if you realize, if you bought a mezuzah or a tefillin since the war broke out, it's actually gone up. Because it's in high demand and it's a lot of labor. And actually, there's a lot of organizations that are trying to raise money and different organizations all over the world raising money to give soldiers tefillin because a lot of them have taken upon themselves to put on tefillin every day. It's truly unbelievable, right? The other thing that, you know, keeps you focused, and I think this is an important thing when we have challenges, when, you know, everyone knows this, right? But I'll just share with you an idea before I tell you this, and that is, you know, in the Amidah every day, right, we have our daily tefillah, right? And in the Amidah, the Amidah is a long list of requests from Hashem, right? That's what Amidah is, the weekday Amidah I'm talking about. We ask for health, and we ask for parnasah, we ask for different things, right? There's a bracha called Shema Koleinu, where you can kind of think about anything that you need, any challenge that you have, call out to God, scream to God. That's what it is. So God commands us to pray. It's called Bakashat Srachav. We seek, we ask for our needs. So essentially, if you think about what the Amidah is on a simple level, when we daven, the first three brachot are just praising Hashem, but then we have a middle section of Amidah, which is basically we go through our shopping list, and basically we're telling God what's not going well, essentially, right? And what we still need, and what has to happen, and what we need for our kids, for ourselves, for our spouses, for family, for the community, for this one's sick, that one's sick, all these things, right? And then at the end, we have blessings of gratitude. And what is that? We say, Mordim anachnu lach. We thank God. And in that paragraph where we thank God, we say, Al nisecha shebechol yom, al niflotecha shebechol eit. Al nisecha shebechol eit, or whatever. We thank you for the miracles that happen every single day, and for the wonders that you do at every time, right? We've just finished going through a whole long list of things that are not going well, or not going as well as they could be. And then suddenly we switch and we say, you know, but there's many miracles. And that's an amazing thing, right? Because that's true. We all have blessings in our life, even though we might have things that we need. And we all have miracles in our life. Now, why God doesn't just do it as one big miracle? We don't know. That's part of emunah. Why gives us challenges? We don't know. Sometimes it's a test. Sometimes it's to make us stronger. We don't know. God has a plan, nor should we understand. We don't need to know why, we just need to know what we do with it. But, right, that's the famous thing, right? We never answer the question why, nor should we, but we just need to know what we can, but how and what are we going to do with it, right? So that's in our own personal lives. What I noticed in Israel is that, and I got a much better understanding when I was there now, just from the different talks that we had, is there's an amazing recognition of, despite the horrors of what's happened in the last year and a half, or more than a half now, there's an incredible recognition of the amazing miracles that happened, both on October 7th and beyond, right? So for example, we were going down south, and we had an amazing, Ari Briggs was doing the tour guiding on the bus. And first of all, it was amazing. I actually had no, I have an understanding. That's because I also have a very bad sense of space and direction and geography. But I had no understanding of how far the terrorists actually infiltrated. Like they showed us on the road, how far they actually came in, right? And then an incredible thing that I never knew, I don't know if maybe many of you know this, but of course, one of the horrible tragedies of October 7th was Nova Festival. But in a very bizarre way, it was actually miraculous. Because they actually, the terrorists had an unbelievable plan. They knew exactly what they were doing, where they were going, addresses, what they came, what they wanted to do in each house, and so on and so forth. But they actually didn't know about Nova Festival. And they got completely distracted. And although tragically killed many people, but in a funny, in a strange way, it actually prevented much more death, actually, because there were towns they were going for that they never reached, right? And an incredible miracle that happened that day, and no, and this is very interesting, because we had a couple of really secular people talk to us, and they couldn't explain it. Someone asked if it was God, he said, maybe, or it must be, that Hezbollah didn't join. It was part of the plan. Part of Hamas's plan was that Hezbollah was going to join at the same time. They would do exactly the same thing.
Which had come from the north.
Yeah, they would come from the north. Which would have been an unspeakable tragedy.
Mm.
And they didn't. I mean, they kind of did after a few days, but that time the army was there and it was easy and they were fighting. I mean, there were tragedies and people evacuated and so on, but had it happened October 7th, which was their plan, no one can explain to you, for what I understand and from what I've spoken to people, and what they spoke to us, no one can explain why it didn't happen. Other than some sort of weak excuse that Astralda was a very insecure guy and he was scared. I don't know. I mean, that doesn't make really sense. But so yeah, so it's like the Amidah on steroids. In other words, it's challenges, it's unbelievable tragedy, it's things we don't understand, things which we just have to have emunah to be able to comprehend. But at the same time, modim anachnach, we thank you for the amazing miracles. Right? And so Rav Rimon gave us a talk, and he's very positive, and also he talked about, I remember some of the other things he mentioned that were really, really miraculous. Iran with the missiles that twice, right? It was an incredible miracle. No one exactly could understand that. Interesting enough, when I was flying there, that's when the Houthis sent a missile on the airport. And if you saw the picture, you could see it in real time. It was right next to the control tower. No one was hurt. There was a few light injuries, but no one was killed. And the airport, another, by the way, I think I was thinking about the difference between Australia and Israel. So I got Wi-Fi in the middle of I went through Dubai, and I turned on my Wi-Fi in the middle of the flight. And I read about this, that hit the airport and they've closed the airport temporarily. I'm thinking, that's nice. I'm on the way to Dubai. I'm supposed to take a flight from Dubai to Israel, right? By the time I got to Dubai, they'd already cleaned up the airport. Everything was fine. It was an hour or two later. Back to normal. I think in Sydney it would have taken 3 weeks, probably, at least. But I mean, don't get me wrong. Sydney's a nice place. But you know, over here, it's different. Like I saw, boom, back to normal flight. That's what they do there. They just go back to normal, right? An incredible miracle. It was really a miracle. I mean, Iran's missiles, that they 300 missiles, whatever it was an unbelievable. So there's many, many miracles. And there's, of course, individual miracles. I mean, this Yiftach again, he said it was a miracle. There's no way to explain it, how he was saved on October 7th. So there's that balance, but there's that, you know, the pain, you experience it, but at the same time, just incredible. And there's a recognition of that. And I think that's something, again, to learn from. You know, we all go through challenges and the whole world becomes dark. You know, they talk about, in modern literature, they talk about every night sort of sitting down and having a gratitude journal, right, to recognize the blessings of the day. In Yiddishkeit, we do that at the beginning of the day. We say Madeani, and also we say the morning blessings. The morning blessings are just thanking God for simple things, like having clothes to wear, being able to see, not taking things for granted, and recognizing the good, as well as praying to Hashem to take away the bad, right? I want to just mention this because this was the most unbelievable experience. We went to a place called Shura. Does anyone know what Shura is? So Shura is, it's near Tel Aviv, it's the rabbinic base of Tzahal. Right, rabbinic base of Tzahal. But it's also the Chevra Kadisha of Tzahal. And they became the center after October 7th to process all the bodies, identify them and so on. But what happened was, it wasn't, normally it's only for military people. So when a soldier comes in that's been killed, God forbid, so there's identification process, you have to go through that process. But it's not for civilians, but on October 7th there was nowhere else to go, so all the civilians came there. So we had a tour. I think these things are important. I mean, this was hard, I gotta tell you. This was really hard. And I think the only reason that it wasn't so hard at the end was because of the guy giving us the tour. This is the craziness of this whole thing, right? You know, I officially, you know, you do these missions, they're called a solidarity mission. So the concept is we go to strengthen them, right, and to strengthen the people there. And then, by the way, they're very, very appreciative. When you visit soldiers, you visit these army bases, when you visit, I mean, they are really genuinely full of gratitude. But I think it's a mistake, that whole line. Like, you know, they say lechazek, to give strength. I said it's more lehitchazek, it's the grain strength, right? Maybe we gave people strength, but I think I got much more strength than I gave, right? So this guy got us through it. He did an amazing job. He brought us into the horrors of this place, honestly, and then lifted us up to like such a space. I'll give you an example. So he told us about this whole thing. So what it is, and I think it's important not to deny the challenge, not to deny pain, right? But so after October 7th, this guy is a guy, he said he had actually fought in the army because when he joined the army, his role, I mean, not everyone in the army fights, right? So his role was be part of the rabbinic team. He's in the rabbinic of Sahel. It's a whole section, you know, conversion, kashrut, you know, every army base is kosher in Israel. So that was his job in the army, and then he left the army after. He's a young guy, but way past the army. And then he like joked, he said, you know, I used to go back for Miluim, but he said, I only did Miluim one day a year, because they didn't need me. He said, what was the one day a year? One day a year before Pesach, I was called to go back to my base, to go kash all the kitchens in the in the army bases for Pesach. So that was his, he's open about it. He says, you know, that was his role, everyone has to do something, so that was his thing. He's a Talmud Chacham, he's quite a Torah scholar, this guy. His name is Bensi, I've forgotten his last name. But then he says, now, October, Simchat Torah happened, he was called back, and he's been there ever since. It's hardly gone on. It's unbelievable. And he's really running the whole process thing. And he says, right after Simchat Torah, all the bodies came there, and you can imagine what he saw. And as soon as the war broke out, before they started coming, the bodies, a friend called him up and said, I'm praying for all the Chayalim. What's your name? I want to pray for you. So he started to laugh. He said, what are you going to pay? Pray for me. That I don't get a paper cut or something? Like, I'm not fighting. And he said, it took him 2 days, and he realized, no, he does need people to pray for him, because there's physical danger and then there's emotional danger. And he says he knew that what he's about to enter is going to be very emotionally dangerous, right? But he's got an amazing perspective about it. And he went through the whole process, because, I mean, often it was impossible to identify and there were body parts and without going into all gory details, but it was just horrendous, right? So they have a whole process. They have four stages. One is fingerprints. That's what they do first. Then there's... No, sorry. First one is, obviously, there's a face. There's face recognition. You bring two people that knew the person. If that's not possible, they try fingerprints. Then they go to teeth. And then they... Fingerprints works with military people much better because their fingerprints are all on record. Because when you enter the army, you're fingerprinted. But for civilians, that was not so simple. And then when all else fails, they went for DNA, which is something that we're able to do today, which is different, right? But he went through the whole thing, what he different, you know, there's different parts of the person, different places. It's very horrendous. But he started off by framing it in the most, this is again such a beautiful thing to do. He was emotionally himself, and I'm sure he's told the story many times because he takes other groups, but he told it very emotionally, brought us into the whole emotions of it. I mean, there was one person that actually had to leave there. I'm just telling you how intense it was, right? There was a lot of tears that day. But he says that when, at the beginning, when all this was happening, the very first few weeks of the war, there was just the whole parking lot was just full of body bags, right? And he said that Rabbi Mervis, Chief Rabbi Mervis, was coming to visit. He was going to go visit. He's the chief rabbi, so he's rabbinic, and he was going to go visit the site. And before he came to Israel, he spoke to President Herzog. And President Herzog said to him, I believe that you're going to Shar HaGehinom. You're going to the gate of perjury of hell, right? Because that's how horrendous this place was. So on the spot, Rabbi Mervis tells him no. He says no. And he quoted a pasuk, he quoted a verse from when Yaakov woke up from his dream, when he was running away from Esav and he was going towards Lavan. And he had this dream where God appeared to him and said, I'm going to take care of you, and so on. And the pasuk says that Yaakov woke up and he said, Manorah ha-makom hazeh, how awesome and how fearful this place is. Ein zeh ki'im beit elokim, it must be the house of God. V'zeh shar ha-shamayim, it's the gate to heaven. He said, I'm not going to shar ha-gehinom, I'm going to shar ha-shamayim. And this Bensi, he sort of framed it that way. He said, you know, holy place, you know, a place where people who died sanctifying God's name and they gave up their life. And this is, they're the highest people, they're the highest tzaddikim, which is, of course, true, right? It's the, I mean, so many different tzaddikim would say this. You know, the tour guide for Mount Herzl told us this. Har Herzl is right next to a yeshiva called Kol Torah. And Kol Torah had a very famous Rosh Yeshiva called Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. And Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, once one of his students came over to him and said to him, he'd like to take a day off because he feels he wants to go pray at the graves of tzaddikim. He wants to go up north, it's Fata, no, the Harizal, the Eretz Yisrael is full of graves of great tzaddikim. And Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said, you're going to take off a day of learning to just go visit graves at Davin? He said, yeah, but it's important. I think I need it. So Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says, I don't know why you need to do that. I also need sometimes to pray at graves of tzaddikim. And when I feel the need, that's a 5-minute walk. I go to Mount Herzl and I pray there. That's the graves of tzaddikim. Very beautiful way to put it. So he said, so back to this thing. So the Benzi starts the tour. He says, you should understand you're in the Beit HaMikdash here. You're in the holiest place of Israel. And he went through the whole thing. And then at the end, he kind of told some very uplifting stories of families that said goodbye and what they did and how they prayed. And anyway, just, then he talked about the whole idea that we have to go away from there, even though he just put us through this very heavy hour. He gave us this very inspirational talk of how we need to see this as part of the rebuilding of Eretz Yisrael, part of the preparation for Mashiach. And it's just that sort of that whole, again, that sort of the whole combination, which is so kind of amazing. I'll just finish with two things. First of all, just to, this is not really part of the whole resilience of Israel, but it's just, I say this every time I come back from Israel, but we did some very beautiful things there, not to do with the war particularly. One is, I did this personally with someone else. So we were staying in Primo King Hotel, which is King George and Ramban, which is not far from the old city. So I've never done this, but apparently, I heard about this, that the Kotel in the morning, people are very alive there. It's like, that's what I want to say, spiritually alive, focused, like just alive. And there's this concept, some people, you know, some people think getting up 6:30 in the morning to daven is like a real challenge. But at the Kotel, but there's a concept that all over the world sometimes, some people do it, of davening with sunrise. That you do the Amidah with the sunrise. Now in the winter, that's okay, but in the summer, it's pretty early, right? So right now, it means you have to start davening about 5:15 in order to hit the sunrise, in order to hit the Amidah about 20 to 6, whatever. So I heard it's all very beautiful, the Kotel, when you do that. So I decided I want to try it. I actually ended up doing it twice. It was so beautifully, so amazing. So yeah, every kind of Jew there. The one day, I'm telling you, there were about 2,000 people there. Mm-hmm. And it was Friday. So I came back and I told a friend. I said, you know, there were much more people today. He said, yeah, because it's Friday. You know, Friday is different because they don't work. I said, I'm sorry, I don't understand you. I know in Australia, when it's Sunday, people get up later, not earlier. But anyway, apparently Israel doesn't work like that. But so they were there. And you know how the Kotel works? There's all different minyanim, right? And it's a big tumult, like it's hugely loud. But when you do the sunrise minyan, what's beautiful is they're all davening to the same clock. Mm-hmm. So suddenly what happens is, let's say it's 20 to 6 or 19 to 6, whenever the sunrise is, the place all of a sudden goes completely quiet. And every minyan is doing the Amidah. It's the most beautiful, beautiful thing. The other thing, of course, which I always do there, and I've done it 3 times now, but every time you see something new, is Ir David. Right? And if any of you have been to Ir David? Ir David, you know what Ir David is? Let me just explain. I think it's important to know about this because I'll explain why in a minute. Because Ir David is about, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago. I've been doing digs there for longer than that. What we call today the Old City of Jerusalem, which is sort of west of the Kotel, right, west of the Beit HaMikdash, is not really the Old City. Meaning, it's Old City, it's got walls, which were built about 400 years ago. But that's not where the main, that's not where King David set up shop. That's not the city of where King David was. King David was more to the east of the temple, Temple Mount, right? And it's only in our times, after 67, that with archaeological digging, they started to discover the city underneath the ground, the entire city, right? And they keep on digging and digging and digging. And they found incredible things there, incredible things. For example, one of the things they've discovered is the place, and you can see the ruins of it, part of the walls. These are walls of 2,000 years old. There are walls there that are dated 4,000 years old, back to the time of Avraham Avinu. That's the place Avraham Avinu, when he went to Yerushalayim, that's where he went. Yitzchak, Yaakov, and so on. And there's the ruins of the palace of King David there. And it's fascinating. The tour guide is a very passionate guy. And he was showing us things, then opening up a Tanakh, and like almost screaming the Pesukim. And you say, you see what it says? This is that. So what happened was, this is an amazing thing, that you see there a piece of an ornament, that the only place you can find that type of artwork is in, I don't know what you call it in the modern day, but it's called Sur, Tyre, in Tanakh language. And we know from Tanakh that when King David bought his palace, he went to the people of Sur. They thought he was going to declare war against them, and he wasn't. He wanted to make peace with them. And in exchange, they came back and they built his palace using artwork from their country. And you see actual parts of David HaMelech's palace, right? You're standing on the spot that David HaMelech said to him. You're standing on a place where 4,000 years ago, Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov were, right? They lived there, but they went there. And what you also go is they discovered recently, a few years ago, it's not even open to the public yet properly, Hurdus, Herod, rebuilt a lot of, I don't know if you know this, he was a master builder, right? He built the Masada and all that. Herod, King Herod, he rebuilt a lot of Jerusalem. Part of what he did was he built this amazing road, right? Amazing road that should go from the bottom of the city, because it's a hill, all the way up to the Beit HaMikdash, and it was specially used around the time when Jews would go on Yontif, come from all over Israel to go to the Beit HaMikdash, right? And they discovered this road by mistake. What happened was, near David, someone had a house, and he had a leak. And they couldn't find where the leak is coming from. And it wasn't by archaeologists. What happened was, the water company, whatever, they were doing a little bit of digging, and they suddenly came to like a whole hollow place, and they discovered this road. And then the archaeologists took over, and over a bunch of years, they dug out this whole road, which Herod had built with a floor underneath the road as an unbelievable drainage system. But I'll just share with you, because I always get very excited about this, because when you learn the Mishnah, you learn the Gemara, and then you see things in real life, it's amazing. So this road, it's stones, you're walking on the original stones, 2,000 years old. Imagining how Jews would go there, there'd be thousands and thousands, sometimes even millions of Jews going towards the Beit HaMikdash. And there's like a sidewalk on the side of the road, which they think was like shops. Shops, right? And then there's one place where suddenly there's like a stairs and a platform in the middle of the road. On the side of the road, but like in front of the shops area. What they think it is, which makes a lot of sense, if you look at the Gemara talks about if someone loses something, there's a mitzvah to return a lost article, right? But if I find something in the street, you can't just come and tell me it's yours. First of all, I have to make an announcement. So what they would do is, around the Yontif time, there would be a platform in Yerushalayim, in the road, main road, and someone would go up there and he would announce who lost the wallet, who lost this, right? People would come and then they have to produce a sign. Like, okay, how do you know it's your wallet, right? The tour guide, as he was talking about this, his wallet fell out of his thing. And I just thought it was a mistake. And like this thing, and I picked it up. I was giving it back. He says, no, hold on to it. And he, like, enacted the whole thing. So after that, I said, okay, so what's the siman then? I'll go on the stairs, but then tell me, what's your sign? Anyway, it was a nice moment. But so it's like incredible. You're seeing like a live part of the Gemara. You're seeing where it happened, right? Then they discovered recently, and this part I didn't see last time I was there, they discovered that there was a wall behind this platform. And no one actually knew yet what the wall was for. But as they kept digging, they realized that there was this platform and they would do these announcements. Then there was a wall which originally must have gone to the much, much higher. And they discovered behind the wall a mikveh. Because presumably because people go up to the Beit HaMikdash, you couldn't go in if you were impure. You had to go to the mikveh. So this was a mikveh on the way. But because it's private, you go to mikveh obviously, so they had to build a wall. Right? So just everything. Why am I telling you this? Because when you go to Israel, we need to sometimes just pinch ourselves and tell us that the whole world is crazy when they sort of challenge our right to Israel. But when you walk on the roads of 2,000 years ago, when you see things, artifacts in Ir David, which date back to Avraham Avinu's time, you see the intrinsic connection that we have with Israel, which explains spiritually and emotionally and historically why there's such a sense of purpose and such a sense of determination to defend the land and to build a nation and to hold on to it, which, because it's ours. It's just, it's who we are. It's a piece of who we are. So I'll just end with two very cute things. One thing that happened the first day I came, and then at the end, just sort of summarize the whole thing. When I came the first day, the morning I came the night before, but then I got up in the morning and I was going to a shop, whatever. I was looking for a shul, I don't know what I was doing. And this bus comes by, you know how they drive in Israel. This bus with a big, big, big placard. A big like sign, huge, like a huge sign. And it said, I'll translate it, it said in Hebrew, for our chatufim, for our hostages, and for the chayalim, omrim b'chol yom, you say every day, and a big Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. I thought, oh, I'm home. This is it, it's Israel, right? And then, finally, when I was going back, so I took I was in lunch for Shabbos, and the ticket, when we were making the ticket, I said, I need to go 11th of May. So no problem, I made a ticket 11th of May, but I didn't realize it was 5 to 1 a.m. It's 11th of May, right? So anyway, I had to leave at Lunchford right after Shabbos to take a taxi. So a taxi guy comes, obviously a religious guy, a Sephardi guy with the yarmulke. So, you know, how taxi drivers drive in Israel. So you got to say a special bracha when you arrive. Anyway, he was doing just that. It was supposed to take an hour and a quarter to get to the airport. I don't know, he got there in 50 minutes, but I didn't ask him. I actually left enough time, but... So first of all, we're driving. It's such a beautiful place. I'm driving for the taxi a few minutes, like about 5-10 minutes. And he says to me, "Nu, ulai tagid mashu chidush pa parashat ha-shavua." He says, "Maybe you can tell me something about the parasha." Over here, the Muhammad that picks me up in the Uber doesn't do that for some reason. So we discussed the parasha for a while. And then I said, you know, I want to ask him, just like a regular guy, he's not in the army at the moment, he's whatever, just a... Every guy lives in Yerushalayim or something. I said to him, how's Israel? And he tells me, Nedar. It's like beautiful. I mean, the country's such turmoil, but it's beautiful. Then he pauses and says, Yesh bayot, there are problems, there are challenges, but we focused. And that sums up Israel for you. And I just think there's a lot of lessons on that idea, which we can take in our own life, but... with regard to Israel. But I think one of the things also, I'll just finish with this, we've been saying this for a while, but I think we need to understand that we can contribute to the war as well, and we need to fight as well. And I think we need to be as determined as they are. Yeah, we all say Tillim every day, and it's nice, and we say Mishra Berach, and we say Amen, and we sing it, Avinu Shebaa Shamayim. Those are all things that we do. But I think actually what I took away from is we need to do more than that. We need to believe, first of all, that spiritual stuff, spiritual ammunition makes a difference. The extra mitzvah we do, the extra learning we do, makes a difference, and we have to be determined to join them. And they feel it, by the way. When you tell them that we daven every day for them and all that, they really feel it. And just they are ready to risk their lives, voluntarily a lot of times. Not even called up, voluntarily sometimes people go, and they just put in the effort, and I think we need to learn from that. In our own life, but just also in this whole journey, to put in the effort, to be with them, very positive, not to be depressed. Depressed is an escape. It's not going to do anything. It's not going to contribute anything. But to be full of emunah, that it's going to be good and will be good. And to contribute by doing something more Jewish. Another mitzvah, another learning, whatever it is. And help them. And B'zrat Hashem, it's all going to come to an end very quickly in a very, very victorious way.
Amen.
Amen. Amen.